In confirmation of our position on Hebrews 10:22, we quote Bloomfield as follows. This is not an admonition to corporeal purity, but the expression turns wholly on the comparison of the legal rite of washing for purification. And there is an allusion to baptism, as also in the foregoing expression we have a parallel with a Jewish rite. The Jews, to use the words of Professor Stewart, were sprinkled with blood in order that they might be purified so as to have access to God. Christians are initially sprinkled, that is, purified by the blood of Jesus. The Jews were washed with water in order to be ceremonially purified so as to come before God. Christians have been washed by the purifying water of baptism. The reader will observe that in this quotation we have not only the authority of Dr. Bloomfield, but also that of Professor Stewart, approvingly quoted by him. But Paul speaks of the body as washed in pure water. We are a little curious to know how it is that a drop of water applied to the head can be regarded as a washing of the body. The Greek word lelumenoi used here indicates a washing of the whole body, while nipsostai is used to indicate a partial washing, as the hands or feet. See MacKnight on this verse. It occurs to us that had the Lord intended a tropical application of water in baptism, he would have designated the part to which it should apply. Surely this was not a matter unworthy of note, for in matters perhaps less significant the parts involved are specifically named. When God instituted circumcision in the family of Abraham, he specifically named the part to be excised. When a man was slain by unknown hands among the Jews, the elders of the city next to him were to wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley. Deuteronomy 21:6. When Jesus washed the disciples' feet, the parts washed are specifically mentioned. John 13:5. When Aaron and his sons were going to enter the tabernacle, they had to wash their hands and their feet. Exodus 40:31. In the consecration of a Jewish priest, there were applications to be made to the head, to the tip of the right ear, the thumb of the right hand, and the great toe of the right foot, and each part is specifically designated. Then, if it were important to thus designate specifically and plainly each part to which an application was to be made in the examples given, it was not less important that the part to be wet in the act of baptism should have been designated with at least equal precision. Why should not Paul have mentioned this part in place of the body which he said was washed in pure water? We respectfully suggest that there is quite as much scriptural authority for baptizing the hand or foot as there is for baptizing the head, and we may justly demand, by what law of Christ or by what example of the apostles is any one authorized to apply water to the face or head rather than to the hands, the feet, or any other part of the body? Baptism of the eunuch. And as they went on their way, they came unto a certain water. And the eunuch said, See, here is water. What doth hinder me to be baptized? And Philip said, If thou believest with all thy heart, thou mayest. And he answered and said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And he commanded the chariot to stand still, and they went down both into the water, both Philip and the eunuch, and he baptized him. And when they were come up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord caught away Philip, that the eunuch saw him no more, and he went on his way rejoicing. Acts 8:36-39. We call the reader's attention to the progressive steps in the foregoing narrative and to the force of the several prepositions used. First, while on their journey, they came unto a certain water. This brings them to, or at, the water. Second, they went down into the water where the baptism took place. Thirdly, they came up out of the water. All this is perfectly rational if immersion was the act performed, but worse than useful if sprinkling or pouring was what was done. If the phrase, come unto a certain water, brought them to or at it, it follows that if the phrase, they went down into the water, moved them at all, it must have carried them beyond its margin, hence a preposition indicating motion into was used to indicate the thought. We have into from the Greek word es, which primarily means motion toward or into, and is therefore correctly rendered in the passage before us. Out of is ek, the primary meaning of which is not from, but out of, just as here rendered. And when construed with water as it is here, it must mean literally out of the water. Hence, es must have taken them just as far into the water as ek brought them out of it. If this language does not show that they really and literally went down into and came up out of the water, then we submit that it is beyond the power of language to express or embody the thought. No more appropriate language could have been used. We have already seen that the rules of translation require the primary meanings of words to be retained unless good reasons be shown for their removal. Therefore, if we substitute the secondary meanings of es and ek in the passage under consideration for into and out of, their primary meanings, there must be a better reason shown for it than the salvation of a favorite theory or the support of an unscriptural practice. But as it is said that es in this passage should be rendered at or near to, it may be well to examine a few passages where the word occurs. It is better for thee to enter, es, into life halt or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast, es, into everlasting fire. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is better for thee to enter, es, into life with one eye, rather than having two eyes to be cast, es, into hellfire. Matthew 18, verses 8 and 9. Here are four examples of es in this quotation which might be as correctly rendered at, as in Acts 8 and verse 37. Thus, enter at life, cast at everlasting fire, etc. Again, depart from me, ye cursed, es, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Matthew 25:41. It would rejoice the hearts of many if es in this place could be rendered at or nearby. Verse 46. And these shall go away, es, into everlasting punishment, but the righteous, es, into life eternal. Matthew 25, verse 46. While the translation of es by at in the verse might bring joy to the wicked, it would destroy the hopes and happiness of the righteous. Numerous examples might be given, but these are deemed sufficient to show the absurdity of translating es otherwise than by into its primary meaning in passages similar to the one under consideration. But Professor Stewart says that if the phrase "they both went down into the water" is meant to designate the action of plunging or being immersed into the water as a part of the rite of baptism, then was Philip baptized as well as the eunuch? For the sacred writer says that both went into the water. Here, then, must have been a rebaptizing of Philip, and what is at least singular, he must have baptized himself as well as the eunuch. Stewart on Baptism, page 97. Here is a false issue made over a most ridiculous quibble by a truly great man. And we may well ask whether truth ever demands of its advocates a resort to such support. We insist that the very fact of such transcendent ability as Professor Stewart possessed being reduced to such straits is evidence that he had a hard cause to defend. He knew well that the act of baptism was not expressed by the phrase "they both went down into the water," but was expressed by "he baptized him." All that is claimed for the language "they both went down into the water" where the baptizing was done and afterward came up out of the water is that it expresses acts wholly incompatible with the notion that baptism was sprinkling or pouring, but perfectly harmonious with the idea that Philip immersed the eunuch. Why was it necessary that Philip and the eunuch should have gone down into the water, or to have even got out of the chariot at all? When he commanded the chariot to stand still, why did he not order the driver to bring a pitcher, bowl, or cup of water with which to baptize the nobleman? Surely anyone traveling in such style, and so far as was this nobleman, might well be presumed to have such vessels. Nor will it do to presume them unworthy of mention had they been employed in connection with the sacred rite. For when Jesus washed the disciples' feet, the basin that contained the water and the towel wherewith he was girded were both thought worthy of their notice and therefore recorded. Was the use of such implements of any more importance connected with the washing of feet than a bowl, pitcher, or cup would have been in connection with baptism, had any such thing been employed? Is it not a little remarkable that we have no account of Peter, James, John, or Philip's taking a little water from any such vessel for the purpose of baptizing anyone, since for the want of any such facility they were compelled sometimes to leave the house at midnight in order to perform this rite? Not only so, but we find them going where there was much water, baptizing in a river, going down into and coming up out of the water, none of which is more worthy of note than would have been a bowl or pitcher had it been employed. But it is insisted that, as the eunuch was reading the 53rd chapter of Isaiah when Philip approached him, it is likely he had previously read the 52nd chapter, the 15th verse of which says, "So shall he sprinkle many nations." And as Philip preached Jesus, as the party referred to, when he came to the water, the eunuch concluded that there was a suitable place for him to be sprinkled, as one of a nation referred to. We have the word sprinkle in Isaiah 52, verse 15, from the Hebrew word naza, which Genesius thus defines, to leap, to spring, to exult, to leap for joy, when applied to liquids, to spurt, to spatter, to sprinkle. The reader will please note the fact that the word naza only means to be sprinkled in the passive form and only then when it refers to liquids. And as in Isaiah it refers to nations and not liquids, this meaning will not apply. Hence we must adopt one of the first meanings, and these are all expressive of joy or rejoicing. A distinguished scholar renders this verse, "So shall many nations exult on account of him." Perhaps the thought would be correctly expressed thus, "Many nations shall rejoice at his coming." Dr. Barnes, the celebrated Presbyterian commentator, says, "It may be remarked that whichever of the above senses is assigned, it furnishes no argument for the practice of sprinkling in baptism. It refers to the fact of his purifying or cleansing the nations, and not to the ordinance of Christian baptism. Nor should it be used as an argument in reference to the mode in which that should be administered." Commentary on Isaiah 52, verse 15. Baptism of the Jailer. "And when they had laid many stripes upon them, they cast them into prison, charging the jailer to keep them safely, who, having received such a charge, thrust them into the inner prison, and made their feet fast in the stocks. And at midnight Paul and Silas prayed and sang praises unto God, and the prisoners heard them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened, and everyone's bands were loosed. And the keeper of the prison, awaking out of his sleep, and seeing the prison doors open, he drew out his sword, and would have killed himself, supposing that the prisoners had been fled. But Paul cried with a loud voice, saying, Do thyself no harm, for we are all here. Then he called for a light, and sprang in, and came trembling, and fell down before Paul and Silas, and brought them out, and said, Sirs, what must I do to be saved? And they said, Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved, and thy house. And they spake unto him the word of the Lord, and to all that were in his house. And he took them the same hour of the night, and washed their stripes, and was baptized, he and all his, straightway. And when he had brought them into his house, he set meat before them, and rejoiced, believing in God with all his house." Acts 16, verses 23-34. It is insisted by those who oppose immersion that the jailer was baptized in the house at or after midnight, and hence was baptized by sprinkling or pouring. We frankly admit that, should we find, on examination, he was baptized in the house, it would raise a presumption in favor of their hypothesis, but still, it would not be conclusive, for persons are often now and might then have been immersed in the house. On the other hand, should we find that he left the house at the time indicated in order to be baptized, it must raise a strong presumption in favor of immersion. Let us, then, very carefully examine as to how this was. "Who, having received such a charge, thrust them into the inner prison, and made their feet fast in the stocks." Here we find that Paul and Silas were lodged in the inner prison. Let us watch them closely, and see how and when they leave and whither they go. Then he, the jailer, called for a light and sprang in and came trembling and fell down before Paul and Silas and brought them out. Out where? And they spake unto him the word of the Lord and to all that were in his house. Here we learn that the jailer had brought them from the inner prison into his house where the preaching was done. And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their stripes and was baptized, he and all his straightway. Remember that the preaching took place in the house. Then the jailer took them to a place where there was water enough to wash their stripes and to baptize him and all his. Was this in the house? Surely not. For in the next verse we are informed that when he had brought them into his house, he set meat before them. How could it be said that they were brought into the house after baptism if they had not left the house to be baptized? Seeing then that they were not baptized in the house, but left it in the night to be baptized, we claim the benefit of a strong presumption in favor of immersion. For surely no one would now think of leaving the house at such an hour of the night to sprinkle or pour a few drops of water on anyone in lieu of baptism. But we are told that in the morning Paul and Silas refused to leave the prison, and it is unlikely that they would have left it the night before, as it would have been dissembling in them to do so. We beg the objector to remember that it was one thing to leave the prison in company with the keeper in the discharge of sacred duty and return in ample time to be ready to meet the charges which had been preferred against them, and quite another thing to leave the prison and the city privately without a trial or an honorable acquittal, thus furnishing their enemies with a pretext for saying they had fled from justice. They had given abundant evidence of the fact that they did not wish to escape by not leaving the prison when the doors were opened and the bands loosed. And as he had saved the jailer from a violent death at his own hands, it is reasonable to suppose that his confidence in them was such as allowed no fears of efforts on their part to escape. All things considered, we are driven to the only probable solution of the matter, which is that they left the house and went to where there was water in which to be immersed and were immersed. In commenting on a phrase in the writings of Justin Martyr, "They are led out by us to a place where there is water," Professor Stewart says, "I am persuaded that this passage as a whole most naturally refers to immersion. For why, on any other ground, should the convert who is to be initiated go out to the place where there is water? There could be no need of this if mere sprinkling or partial effusion only was customary in the time of Justin." Stewart on Baptism, page 144. Now, if the fact that going to a place where there was water to baptize in the days of Justin was evidence of immersion, why is not the same fact evidence that the jailer was immersed, especially when we remember that he went at or after midnight? If Professor Stewart's conclusion was a reasonable deduction from the language of Justin, and we think it certainly was, why does he not come to a like conclusion to the baptism of the jailer? Yea, why should we not come to a like conclusion in a case surrounded by similar circumstances? That he did leave the house to be baptized is as certain as the language of Holy Writ can make anything. Yet Professor Stewart gives the baptism of the jailer as one of three cases where immersion was not the act performed. As to whether or not he is consistent, the reader will judge for himself.